Coming up today, we take a ride in Ford's self-driving car, super interesting free Wi-Fi news, and why everyone is very excited about Amazon's life-snooping whatsamajig. You're listening to episode 285 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. Now, Matt Burgess has written the script this week, so I'm just going to keep going. I'm your host, James the Pie Temperton, and joining me are Matt Burgess. Hello.
Hello.
And Matt Reynolds for one last time, RIP.
Hello.
It is your last hour at Wired.
Yeah, I know.
So I've collected together an emotional tribute to you. In the form of... No, I haven't. Right, so let's... It's your last hour. We're recording this at just gone 4 o'clock, so we will soon be heading to the pub to toast you farewell.
Yeah, last hour in the cupboard.
But you'll still be floating around the Wired office. You're not disappearing forever.
Yeah, it can't get rid of me.
No, we won't let you go away. Right, a thing you learned this week, Matt Reynolds.
Yeah, so I learned this week that Kinder Eggs, everyone's favourite childhood, chocolate slash... rubbish toy sweet, they're illegal in America.
As well they should be.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe not for the reasons you want them to be illegal.
No, we've all choked on a spinning top.
Well,
why hide a toy in food?
You're doing Kinder Eggs wrong. You're doing them so wrong.
Just straight in the mouth. So the reason is, so Kinder Eggs were invented in 1970, in the 70s, yeah. But there's a 1938 law that bans the import of confectionery items that fully encase toys. So there's one kind of sweet in America that kind of gets around this because it has a little bit of the toy visible. So it's just the full encasing of a toy. I don't know, maybe they don't like surprises in America.
Yeah, and it's in the name, Kinder Surprise.
I know, exactly.
Not such a nice surprise when you choke.
Yeah, but do not smuggle them into America because you'll be arrested and deported and all that.
Probably. Wow. Yeah, tough stuff. Matt Burgess, what did you learn?
When elephants throw sand and other debris and stuff onto their back, it's actually to stop them being sunburned, apparently.
Huh.
They get burnt like other mammals and creatures.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. Well, when the heat wave that we had in the UK, quite recently, there was a local news item about someone putting sun cream on pigs.
Yeah.
Because they need it. Otherwise, they get burnt.
And it'd become bacon.
Hey.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there we go. Not nice to the vegetarians. Right. I learned, and this was somewhat hastily put together, but the Chang'e 2 space station, which is China's second experimental space station, literally translates to Heavenly Palace 2, which is just an excellent name for a space station. So there's going to be a couple of Chinese astronauts on there next month, and they're going to be there for 4 weeks carrying out a series of experiments on board. And this is all because I believe China isn't allowed on the ISS. So
it's going
it alone and building its own space program, which kind of seems counterproductive. Space is all about collaboration.
Yeah, although I think they're also like, God, we can own a bit of this, we'll have this. And also, if you've got that awesome name, like, do you want to go to the International Space Station? No, I'm going to the Heavenly Palace, mate. So,
yeah, it's true. And, not to give away a spoiler, but people who have seen Gravity will know that the Chinese Space Station could potentially play an important role were something to go wrong. Although, maybe that's Hollywood with creative license. Yeah. Our first story this week, which requires no creative license. It sounds dull, but it's actually kind of cool. Matt Reynolds, go.
Yeah, cool. So, do you remember the European Union? There's been some news about it, hasn't there? So, they are planning on installing free Wi-Fi in public spaces across all European Union member states. So, it's meant to be in public spaces by 2020. So, the president of the European Commission, who I've been told is called Jean-Claude Juncker. He announced, he does like an annual State of the Union address, and this is where he announced these new plans. He said, to quote him, "We propose today to equip every European village and every city with free wireless internet access around the main centres of public life by 2020.
Whoa. Everyone.
I know, because I'm thinking a lot of, you know, European villages now don't have wired internet access, let alone, free public internet access.
And it's kind of presuming that they have a main centre for public life. And quite a lot of villages are just sort of spindly collections of houses with Tesco's dumped in the middle of them.
It's
UK,
the Tesco's.
Anyway.
Yeah, Wi-Fi and Tesco's.
Which doesn't necessarily help to improve our lives. So, as you put here, sounds good to me. What else are they doing?
Yeah, so yeah, they're really on this, actually. So they've also restated their plans to fully deploy 5G mobile networks across the European Union by 2025. Juncker here said it had a potential to create a further 2 million jobs in the EU. Obviously, deploying these wireless networks, when we upgrade these network communications, they require a lot of infrastructure changes. 2025 really does seem a bit ambitious if you compare that to what companies have been doing and what they've been saying.
It's incredibly ambitious. Yeah, and but politicians do love standing on stages and saying how kind of that faster broadband and faster connections and greater access to communications, this kind of thing, is going to do X, Y, and Z to the economy. And it sounds impressive at the time, but the actual technical side of things that companies like Nokia and Samsung are involved in shows that it's probably a lot further off than 2025, at least in Europe.
Yeah, exactly. So Nokia actually earlier this month had been talking about rolling out 4.5G Pro, which is about 10 times... It's about 10 times faster than our current internet speeds. They're hoping to launch that by the end of the year. They're also bringing out 4.9G, which is almost there to 5G. But basically, you know, 5G isn't on the immediate horizon. We might have some of it by 2020, but it's not going to, you know, there are 500 million 4G users in the world right now. And I think one telecoms expert predicted that by 2021 there'll only be 25 million 5G users. So that's the kind of level we're aiming for. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it all sounds very, very like optimistic, fantastic, but there is one giant sunburn elephant in the room, and that is Brexit. Are these like EU proposals going to have any effect on us if we've left the EU by 2020 or 2025?
Yeah, I know. You imagine, should they put that on the ballot, you know, in the EU, free Wi-Fi, out of it, no. So basically, yeah, Juncker mentioned Brexit, obviously, a bit implicitly. He said the EU was suffering a existential crisis. I've had a couple of those, so I know what that's like. And he also said, never before have I seen national governments so weakened by the forces of populism and paralysed by the risk of defeat in the next elections. You know, a very obvious swipe at the Brexit vote in the UK. He didn't actually make it clear how Brexit is going to affect these plans. To be honest, I think it's pretty fair to assume that if we're not in the club and the club's paying for the free Wi-Fi, we don't want to contribute to that club. You know, I think we're going to be shut out. So no free Wi-Fi in Village.
Free
Tesco's.
Wi-Fi is unlikely to be a deal breaker in very complex negotiations to leave the European Union. But it could be. Everyone loves free Wi-Fi. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But we should, just to go back to the 5G thing. It's something that I didn't really have defined in my head until quite recently. And you think, oh, okay, so the difference between 3G and 4G, 4G is way quicker. 5G isn't necessarily quicker, it's just better. How often do you actually get the 4G speed that your network promises, you know, like up to 50 megs a second or 30 megs a second?
Not often at all, I'd imagine.
Yeah, not very often at all, because the amount of people overloading the network and just problems of getting through buildings and interference and all this sort of thing. If you're ever on a train, 3G, 4G completely falls off, right? So 5G is not necessarily going to be way, way quicker, but it will be much more robust and much more capable of replacing a broadband connection and being a broadband connection everywhere. Even if you're moving quickly, there's loads of interference, someone's turned a microwave on, it will be able to cope with the rigors of modern life. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can switch between your 5G connection in France to your public Wi-Fi when you end up at the water fountain. Or
seamless, if they allow you to have a visa to get in if you're from the UK. Second story, let's not do politics, ad blocking, which is kind of political.
It can be. It depends on what side of the fence you sit on. So Adblock Plus, which is one of the biggest ad blockers on the web, and I think it's got around 100 million users across websites and also across mobile phone devices, is actually going to start selling adverts.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
You did hear that right. I did say Adblock Plus, which blocks ads, is an ad blocker, is going to be start selling its own adverts. Which, it does sound a bit hypocritical.
It does sound a bit hypocritical, yes.
And I guess it sounds a bit like when Amazon decided that it would start to open physical bookshops.
Yeah, it just sounds wrong. But Adblock Plus, to its thinking, has good reason to do this, and it's a clever idea.
there is some logic behind it, yes. So they've announced that they're creating an acceptable ads platform. And in reality, this means that it will allow so-called compliant adverts to be shown to users. So the adverts that comply with sizes and placements set out by the company can actually be shown by publishers and bloggers on their website. So the platform is really a market for publishers to put ads in. And the company says that it's created an intuitive drag-and-drop editor so that publishers can put ready-made ads into their sites in real time. And basically, they're going to be selling these adverts that they think are good adverts, really, rather than bad adverts, and they can be put into ready-built websites.
Okay, so to our mind, not to their mind, what makes an advert good or bad?
So they say they have to be of a certain size. So basically quite thin banner ads, and they have to be at the top of the page or the bottom of the page or maybe in a sidebar. So not an advert like these really annoying ones that pop up halfway through an article and start showing video in the middle of...
Idea where you'd see an advert like that. But this is the problem, isn't it? That you have an ecosystem of publishers that are set up to run ads in quite a well-defined way, and it isn't necessarily a very good way, but it's the way that we've got. But I don't think that the way to persuade publishers and advertisers to, air quotes, behave better is to say, oh, well, no, we know what a good advert is, but the only way that you're going to show it is if you join our program and become part of our weird little club.
Yeah, so I guess the big issue here to explain it to the people that don't know is there are really sort of two camps when it comes to ad blockers. People who use ad blockers and don't want to see any ads at all and have reasons for doing this. So they may obviously not just want to see ads because they find them annoying and intrusive, but there are plenty of ads that collect a lot of user data, which is then fed back into advertising schemes, other schemes like that. There are adverts that also contain malware and viruses and things like that, really dangerous adverts. So people, that's one of the main reasons why people use ad blockers. But on the flip side, people that don't like ad blockers, and it's a very strong community, the main reason is publishers. So our jobs, for example, at Wired, we get paid when we get, well, we don't get paid when, but the advertising rates from our website contribute to our wages, and those advertising rates come from people looking at adverts and having their browsers open and actually scrolling past them and putting their eyeballs on them. So I guess they're the two big sort of camps that are like for and against.
And just to bring this back to AdBlock and AdBlock Plus, has this been something that the software has done since the beginning, or is this a brand new departure?
So they have had this sort of feature of adverts for a while. So since 2011, AdBlock Plus has allowed some non-intrusive adverts that meet their criteria of the size, placements, etc., through their platform. But this is their real big rollout that they're doing, and now they want to actually get it onto a lot more sites and a lot more have a lot more exposure of it, really.
So effectively what came before was a kind of whitelist you could apply to say that your site met certain criteria and AdBlock Plus would agree and allow your ads through.
Yeah, and you can still completely block even these compliant ads if you want.
Yeah. It's a dodgy world, because you see more and more websites now kind of going for the guilt approach, right? So The Guardian, and I think it was on a Scottish newspaper website, The Herald, Wired in the US. You go on there, Bloomberg, I could keep going, and there'll be a little box that says, oh, you're using an ad blocker. You shouldn't really use an ad blocker. Ad blockers stop us from being able to make money, and money supports independent journalism and journalists. You're seeing more and more of that. Has it made either of you? We all use ad blockers, right?
I don't.
You don't?
No, I haven't got one turned on at all. I used to have one turned on, and then it just started, it was breaking a few web pages that I was looking at because the ads weren't there, and the experience, as much as I can find adverts annoying, as anybody can, but it just wasn't quite the same as it was meant to be. So some elements and websites weren't really showing in the same way. So I will put up with adverts for seeing the pages it's meant to do.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I think the guilt thing was what really got me. And when websites that I enjoyed reading were able to put together quite a compelling case for turn off the ad blocker, you're ruining our business model. And particularly when you work in this industry and see what effect ad blockers can have. But then you can see people that don't work in this industry that see these messages popping up on sites and they're like, go away, your adverts are rubbish. I don't want to see them. They're not relevant to me. And then I suppose the flip side of that, right, is the Guardian's model, where they're trying to persuade people to become members. So they send you a tote bag in the post and some literature, and you pay £5 a month or whatever it is. and that helps them. Kind of, it's kind of how Wikipedia works.
Yeah, I mean, for my part on this, I think that, yeah, better adverts are the right way. I think that we need to find a way to make money out of media, because then we can all keep our jobs and stuff like that. That'd be good. But, yeah, I don't know if Adblock Pro, I think like you said, James, I'm a bit worried that as a, you know, commercial organisation, they're like, oh, we're the ones that uphold this standard. I kind of think that maybe it's up to the media agency to be a bit like, we'll deliver you this type of ad. Is that okay? You know, and you can use the ad block if you want, but maybe you only get 5 articles or something. I think there needs to be more of an open dialogue and not just this other authority that then decides what ad's acceptable.
Yeah, because that's all it is. It's just someone else in a room sitting down and saying what is and isn't a good advert. And it doesn't address the fundamental problem that most adverts online are quite bad, quite irritating, and most news sites are struggling to make money through the ad revenue model. So it's a really, really big crunch issue, and it gets us very excited. I don't really know if it gets people outside of the media bubble very excited, but if you care about reading stuff online that's of quality, then this is an issue that needs solving. And I don't think that Adblock Plus's solution is the ultimate one. So we'll see how it goes. Super early days. Our third story this week is about Amazon Echo. It's finally coming to the UK this autumn, 2 years after it launched in the United States. And it will be available.
No.
Yes, in white.
What? That's changed things.
Yeah, this is a game changer. So, not to be dismissive, Amazon Echo is a phenomenal piece of technology. It's been very, very successful. An awful lot of people kind of raised an eyebrow when Amazon announced this thing a couple of years ago in the States. It is effectively a cylinder. It looks a bit like an elongated baked bean tin. It's a speaker. It's a microphone. It's AI. It's kind of a chatbot. It's all of these different things. And basically, it's a bit like it's kind of like Siri. It's kind of like Google Now, but it doesn't have an interface. And it's always on. And so it changes the way that, and I don't know about you, but when I use Google Now on my phone or Siri on my partner's phone, it's quite a conscious thing. You have to go there and do it and want to do it. And there's still that clunkiness to it. Whereas you can just go, Alexa, which is the name of Amazon's assistant, and off you go.
So run me through how this Echo is going to, you know, work in my life. Now, I'm in the kitchen. I want to get some dinner. What do I do?
So, sorry, you're in the kitchen and you want to get some dinner. So, say it was hooked up to Deliveroo or a service like that, or Just Eat. You could say, okay, Alexa, order me such and such a dish from such and such a restaurant. And if the app that Alexa was then referring to in its logic was compatible with those commands, it would just do that. So you could equally say, quite a common thing is, and it's kind of cool, if you have people over for a party or something, you can just say, okay, Alexa, play on Spotify, and it will just start playing music. And you could say, turn that up, and it will get louder, or skip to the next track. It doesn't force you to behave in the way that an awful lot of these speech interfaces do. So yeah, it's coming to the UK. The UK version of Amazon Echo is £149.99 or £150. Amazon Prime customers, of course, can get it today at a discount of £50, which means it costs £99.99 or £100. Yeah, it's been a runaway success in the US. Not a lot of people thought it would be. You speak to people that have been using it in the US for a while, and they're like, yeah, it's great. It's this really clever thing. And it wasn't made by Google or Apple. And then you have Google standing up on stage, I think in May of this year, and announcing Google Home, which is effectively Amazon Echo, but made by Google. It's a cylinder. It sits on a countertop. So it looks like this is going to be a big new thing for an awful lot of companies. Would you use one in your homes?
Well, I'm going to flip that to Matt Burgess.
I've already ordered or pre-ordered a Amazon Echo.
You are the early adopter.
I am that person. And yeah, the reason why I got it was because I've been looking for a new Bluetooth speaker for my bedroom for a while, and I got this at the Amazon Prime discount of £100, so rather than £150. And I thought, to begin with, I could easily get a Bluetooth speaker for around that money, for if not a bit more than that. And that's going to be my primary use for it. But I'm also thinking I'm going to be setting alarms on there. Maybe I'm actually tempted by internet connected light bulbs as well. So now I can just be laying in bed and be like, Alexa, turn the lights off. And I don't even have to get up. But I think the thing is, I'm really excited by this and just the potential that it can do, and just being able to talk to something like this, because it's got, I think, 7 different microphones in the top of it, which detect all the way around your room where you're standing, which is great if you've got a big room. I've got a small bedroom, so that's not really a bit. That's not really going to be an issue.
Thrilling insight into your life. You can be standing in your small bedroom anywhere and turn the lights off rather than just having to stand at the light switch. But this is the other cool thing that it can do. It can hook up with other things that are Wi-Fi connected. So all that Philips say they make connected light bulbs would need to do is build the logic into their application and their service to work with Amazon Echo, a bit like for things to work with Google Now or Siri, that they need to be able to understand each other. But then your command can trigger something without having to open an app. So all of a sudden, you don't have to fiddle around on your phone to turn off the light switch, or get up and turn off the light switch, which most sane people would do.
I'm guessing it would work in Matt's case, as he comes in, he says, right, Alexa, play smooth jazz, and then dims light, Barry White comes on.
Nice, yeah.
That is an insight into my life. But Amazon is actually in the US for the Echo and for Alexa. There are, I think, more than 3,000 basically applications. Amazon calls them skills that it can do. And quite a few of them are coming over to here. And what is important and what's made this successful, I think, is that they've actually made from the beginning this open to developers. So any developers can use their API and create their skills and basically integrate your own product into it. And with Apple's iOS 10 launch this week, that's the first time that they've actually let outside developers access Siri. So now if you've uploaded or updated your iPhone and iPad to the latest iOS, you can actually say, Siri, send a WhatsApp to this company. And I think this is why it's been successful for Amazon, because they've opened it up and made it accessible to people from the word go, rather than like Apple 6 or 7 years down the line.
Which is interesting from Amazon to do this kind of thing first, because with the Kindle, the e-book readers were successful, but there were e-book readers already. They've always been quite good at copying and making things cheaper, the same with the Fire tablets and to a much lesser extent the Fire phone. But this is a really, really great piece of technology that both physically is being copied by Google, and in terms of the sort of things that it can do and the way that it operates are being copied by Apple and Google, and I'm sure many others will follow suit. I just can't imagine it being in my home. I'd feel like a bit of an idiot.
Yeah, so there was, and there has been, and there still are, privacy concerns about this as well. So the way that the Echo works is that actually it is all connected through the cloud. So when you say something, it will send this message that you say, Alexa, can you order me a pizza or something like that. That will go to Amazon servers in the cloud. And to be able to actually do that, it needs to be on and sort of recognizing at all times. And apparently, from what has been said, that it isn't actually recording and listening everything you say at all times, but it's just sort of in a dormant state, looking out for the word that you use to trigger it, which is mostly Alexa, but you can actually change that if you don't want it to be really...
So I could call it Giles.
No, there's only 3 options. You can call it Alexa, Echo, or Amazon, which would be weird just to say, Amazon, can I do this?
But... It needs a boy's name. It does, and it should be Giles. What was I going to say? So the reason it's taken so long to come to Europe is accents, right? So in America, there are a lot of different accents, but you come to the UK, and we have some pretty weird accents. So they've spent an awful lot of time, and I guess bring it to other countries in Europe, they'll hit similar problems. People sound weird. So they've had to get it to be intelligent enough to understand people from up north, and I'm not going to try any others because that was terrible. But yeah, that's a really big challenge for these voice-operated systems, is that not everyone says words in exactly the same way. And then on top of that, not everyone will express themselves in the same way. So... I don't know, you want to turn some music up, you might say, turn it up, louder, bit more, or something like that, right? Not that loud, too loud! Yeah, exactly. So, it's a clever piece of technology, and I'm sort of being persuaded by the amount of people that are very excited about it, and speaking very passionately about how, not it's changed their lives, but that it's a really neat implementation of a piece of technology.
Yeah. I'm a bit like, I think if I can see an example where it'd be really useful, if, for instance, it was super amazingly good at me dictating emails to it, that'd be useful. At the minute, I don't need an easier way to get an Uber or an easier way to order off Just Eat because A, I don't do it very often, and B, it's pretty easy doing it in my phone. But I think if there was a point in my life, like the connected home thing, perhaps, you know, where it actually had a real useful impact every day, then I like it. You know, I want to have a use for it. I just don't think it quite justifies the 150 quid for me.
Mm-hmm. At the moment, it kind of just lets you pretend to be Tony Stark.
I don't know who that is.
Iron Man.
Oh, does he have a voice butler kind of thing?
Mm. Yeah, so it's kind of, you know, you just walk into your home and you're like, lights on, because yeah, you're super swanky, and pour me a drink, and some robot goes and does it, and all you have to do is click your fingers and it's there at your whim. We'll see. We'll see how well it does in the UK. It's definitely a very, very different market. And maybe it'll just be Matt Burgess in his small bedroom turning the lights on and off with his voice. Okay, so earlier this week, Matt Reynolds has been jet-setting on his last week at Wired. Matt, you were in Dearborn, Michigan, to take a ride in Ford's new driverless car. Kind of.
Yeah, so not drive the car, be in the back of a car while two Ford engineers in the front seats didn't drive it either, except for a little bit when one of them actually did have to drive it. Anyway, some background. So by 2021, Ford plans to build what may not be the first fleet of fully autonomous taxis. They want to do away with the steering wheel, with the brake pedal, or any other way for a human to input or take control of the vehicle. And what I tested was a very early prototype.
Right, so by 2021 there won't be two nervous Ford engineers sat on the front seat tapping on laptops and kind of hovering next to the steering wheel in panic.
Yeah, unless they're also taking the taxi with you and it's entirely kind of incidental.
But they wouldn't be able to do anything because there would be no controls.
Yeah, so I kind of spoke about this to their vice president of research and advanced engineering, and they weren't entirely sure, because obviously there has to be some kind of interaction, and they weren't entirely sure. You know, I put the question, well, what if the taxi breaks down or something? And they said what might happen is they might send an engineer with like an Xbox controller style thing, and that would somehow connect to the driverless car, and that, you know, that is how you drive it. Another idea, not that this excludes the Xbox controller idea, is there would be some kind of kill switch. The car I went in on Monday had two kill switches, one to override the AI, one to completely disengage everything. But to be honest, they're not really sure how, you know, the exceptional circumstances will work at the minute.
So it sounds very exciting, taking a ride in a self-driving car, even if there are two engineers involved. What was it like?
Really boring.
Right.
Yeah, so we went on a 1.5-mile journey around the Dearborn campus, which is basically where Ford's headquarters in Michigan are.
Just briefly, like, describe the campus, because it's kind of like a town, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's what they describe as a semi-urban environment, which means you've got lots of people. There are real cars on the road because, you know, part of it is just, you know, a normal part of Michigan. There are also scripted Ford employees that are walking around to test, you know, oh, this is what a pedestrian's like. But, you know, imagine Milton Keynes or a kind of, you know, just semi-urban environment. It's very, very typical of the kind of 25 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour driving you might do, you know, on a quite day-to-day basis, not like a big city.
Yeah, so you're pootling around your campus. You say it's a little boring.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the point. Because so kind of scene set, we've got two engineers in the front seat. One's got a laptop, and that shows what the car is seeing through its radar and LiDAR system. And the other one has got their hands, you know, a couple of inches off the steering wheel, and they're ready to intervene if something bad happens, which did happen. I'll get onto that in a second. But I say boring in actually the nicest possible way, because I think that we want to... It's actually pretty cool to think, wow, this car's driving me, and it's just like being driven by my mum or my nan or by a normal taxi driver. There's nothing remarkable or scary. In fact, the car was really cautious. When we went to a four-way intersection, the driverless car would wait pretty much till it was last. It'd wait till the intersection was entirely clear, and if someone else is about to cut you up, the car would, you know, stop and be like, all right, dude, you go first. In fact, there's a slight element that's maybe too cautious, you know, for real practical driving. But, yeah, it was pretty amazing how capable it was at getting out of the way and just being so normal.
This is what you want, really, from a car, though, isn't it? Like a self-driving car. You don't want it to be taking risks, and you don't want it to be driving really fast around an area. And is that why you say that you mean it's boring but not in a dull way? Or?
Yeah, 100%. I think the fact that it was boring and felt so ordinary just tells us that the technology is actually reasonably advanced to, you know, drive in a safer way. I think if humans are being exhilarating, it's because they're partly being a bit dangerous, perhaps, and doing things you might not expect. And I think the thing that I was really excited about going to Michigan was like, wow, you know, I'm putting my life in the hands of this machine. What will it decide to do? You know, will it veer left? And you know, whatever. And the thing is that that's obviously absolutely what it's not going to do. And because of that, it was boring, but also I was like, I would get into this. Yeah,
but there was one moment of terrifying, unpredictable panic.
And the terrifying, unpredictable panic looks like one man walking slowly in front of you in the road. So yeah, that's exactly what happened. And so what happened is, as I described, there was a man basically walking more or less in the road, you know, in the same direction as us.
He wasn't meant to be there.
No, as the engineer said, this is one of the people that wasn't scripted to be here. This is just a guy that liked walking in the roads, you know. I don't know what he was doing.
Maverick.
Yeah, I know. And so basically what happened is the car slowed down, basically matched the speed of the pedestrian, didn't make any overtaking move, even though the lane to the left-hand side in America was completely free. So obviously it's not that helpful if something gets in front of you in the road that you just kind of stop and match their speed. So our engineer said, I'm going to take control and drive around this, because this wasn't, you know, I think they refer to it as an out of a mission. Yes, it was out of scope for our mission. It's not part of the plan, is what the engineer said. So he took control and drove around this person.
Speaking very much like an engineer.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yes, and while you were pootling around in Ford's remarkably boring self-driving car, which is a good thing, it's a good thing, Uber was bringing out its own driverless taxis in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which kind of doesn't that ape Ford by 5 years?
Yeah, exactly. So with Ford saying in 5 years, as I was literally at a conference saying, you know, in 5 years you can get in this taxi, there's Uber saying, oh no, like tomorrow you can hail that. Today in Pittsburgh, if you're an Uber user, you can flag down an autonomous car. You'll have a Uber safety driver, you know, basically an engineer in the front seat. Very similar setup to the Ford I was in. In fact, it's actually the same car, the Ford Fusion Hybrid. Hmm. Although the technology that does the autonomy stuff, that's slightly different. But yeah, that's out there right now. So that, yeah, they're testing it. I think it's the same rate as a normal UberX, or even a bit cheaper. They're trying to incentivize people to try it.
Yeah.
They've you know, like I said, like in the Ford car, it's got an override. If the person needs to intervene, they can, you know, get involved. It's not going on any super fast roads. It's going at like 25, 30 miles an hour. But this, like you said, it's got a really big jump on Ford, because this technology is out there now. They're testing the roads, you know, they're feeling it out, and the company hasn't given any strict deadlines about when it's going to take the steering wheels away or go fully autonomous, because obviously it's not at the minute. But, I mean, being out there and having those cars there is a big step towards that.
Mm-hmm. So you get into the car, there's an engineer, there's a steering wheel, you're sitting in the back seat. Is anything else different?
Yeah, so there's an app in the kind of central console. So you've probably told the Uber already where you're going to go, but there's also, when you get in, the option to, you know, select a new destination. And also what that app does, it tells you lots of different things about the car. It tells you how fast it's going, if it's in autonomous mode, which it should be. It also gives you a 3D breakdown of everything that's kind of going on around outside the car.
Hmm.
Which I think this is really interesting, actually, because the Google cars, although people really haven't seen inside them to the same extent, are meant to have the same thing, a really big, I think it's a 3D screen that shows you what the car, well, it's a screen of a 3D image of what the car can see. And I think what's really interesting is, because obviously these companies are thinking, how can we make people more comfortable, more confident, more likely to pick up a driverless car? And one way is to see this screen that shows what the car is mapping through its light radar systems, and to say like, oh wow, I mean, this car can see further in front than me. It can kind of see a bit around corners sometimes.
Mm.
I feel confident knowing that it knows that that car over there is moving at 40 miles an hour and it's going to be here then. So I think
about
that's
developing trust.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that you know, none of these companies have really said, when you get in a car, this is exactly what you're going to see. You know, like Uber have said, we might have this app, this tablet in it, we might not. But I think it's interesting to say that the next big battle isn't the technology to drive them, it's like getting that confidence from consumers and from you and me to get in that car.
Mm. At the other end of things, and I think this is a useful point of contrast, Formula E, which is the electric version of Formula One, sort of, is doing some stuff with self-driving cars, with the idea of having an autonomous robo race.
Yeah, so it was announced last year and it's actually started to really progress now. But from slightly later in the year, there is going to be a robo race, which is autonomous cars that don't have any people in at all and are going around a track and basically racing each other. I don't think when it launches slightly later this year at one of the Formula E events, it's actually going to be a full-on race. It's probably going to be more of a exhibition demonstration because the technology is still growing here. But I think one of the reasons that why this has been done is to try and increase people's trust and actually show that these types of AI and cars are actually quite safe and can actually be done in a very controlled and sort of stable manner. So just in the same way that Formula E is out there promoting electric cars, the Robo Race, which will follow the Formula E around the world and is actually being developed by a team in London, that's going to be showing off AI and self-driving cars and really just pushing this into the consciousness of as many people as possible. Like
normalizing it.
Yeah, and they say that they're going to try and do speeds of up to 180 mile an hour. Their test developing car, that which they've called DevBot, has actually been unveiled, and that's going to be, there's been one video of that put out there, and it's showing that probably about 30, 40 mile an hour. There's no actual speed that's showing on this, but it's showing a car going round a track that's completely autonomous and actually making just people see it's real, you can trust it.
Yeah, which is, it's remarkable. You really realize the speed of the development of these kind of things, where you have Matt Reynolds sat in a Ford on Ford's campus, but at the same time Uber has already launched an autonomous taxi service. Yeah. And then pretty soon there are going to be autonomous racing cars going at 180 miles an hour and competing against each other. At first it will be an exhibition, but pretty soon after that you can imagine it being a full-on racing series. That really, really exciting. But then there's a word of caution, and I want to end on this, on our discussion of self-driving technology. So Tesla and autopilot, this is where things get a little bit more difficult. So everything that we talked about so far has been a fully autonomous system. Tesla, of course, has the autopilot system, which is kind of a half and half. It's a bit like cruise control that you might get on a car, where you just keep that steady speed on a motorway and all's hunky-dory. But then when you touch the pedal, you come out and you're in control of the vehicle. So Mobileye, which is the company that develops collision detection and driver assistance systems, actually broke from its deal with Tesla in July following a fatality in one of Tesla's vehicles whilst it was using autopilot. At the time, Tesla said in a statement that Mobileye could not keep pace with how it was changing its product. But Mobileye has now come out and said that Tesla was pushing the envelope in terms of safety with the design of its autopilot system. Chairman and CTO Amnon Shashua, I hope I said that right, told Reuters that Tesla's system was not designed to cover all the possible crash situations in a safe manner. And as I said, a man died as a result of the autopilot system not recognizing a trailer on a tractor because it was white and it was kind of a similar color to the sky. He didn't see it. The autopilot didn't see it. He died.
Yeah, and I think just to be really clear and to the point on this, there is still an investigation going on into this, yeah, and that the autopilot hasn't actually been blamed by officials. But I think the whole case, and I think we've discussed it before, does raise questions about when you implement this technology and when it's ready to be used by the mass public.
And it comes back to trust, because in my mind, I would be terrified to be in a car that was driving itself. Well, not terrified, but slightly perturbed, I think. And it would take a very, very long time for that sort of behavior to be normalized in my head. But obviously, other people, that isn't really the case. Autopilot, so Tesla's going to make changes to it after this fatality, it's said, regardless of the outcome of the investigation. It wants to make it clearer that autopilot means that you probably still have your hands on the wheel, that you're still paying attention to the road, but the car is just taking some of the control away from you. But you should be ready to pounce just like that if you need to take control of the vehicle again. And that's kind of what you've got with the engineer sitting in the front of the Ford car, hovering over the steering wheel. It's still really, really early days for this technology, and fast moving though it may be, it's very dangerous potentially if things go wrong, which is why Ford are probably taking the slightly longer term approach, 2021, and why when you hail your self-driving Uber, you will find an engineer sat in the front seat. But it's been a really, really fascinating week for this technology, and for all of that to happen in 1 week with Uber and Ford, it's incredible. It shows the pace of the innovation, and I'm pretty excited by it.
Yeah, I am. I'm looking forward to a future I never have to drive.
Well, I can't drive, so I mean, it would be great for me.
You're living in the future already.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, trains. They're called trains and buses.
I won't catch on.
Yeah, definitely not. Well, Matt, farewell.
Yeah, cool. See ya.
Right, we're gonna go and sing you a song and make everything very awkward.
The leaving song.
There will be gifts and there will be beer. But yeah, all right, that's it for this week. We won't see you again.
Yeah.
But the Wired Podcast will be back again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.